Twitter is popular in Japan. The Japanese are among the heaviest users of microblogging servers in the world. The company counts 26 million users there, which translates to nearly half of all social media users in the country. But it's not quite so simple, because people in Japan use social media somewhat differently than the rest of us. It's not uncommon, for example, for a Japanese user to have 5, 10, even as many as 15 different Twitter accounts, and to maintain a different identity on each. Japan is also unique in East Asia for fully embracing online anonymity, and it's never sought to implement a real name policy for internet users, as both South Korea and China have. In this week's Asia Digital Life podcast, I try to unravel Japan's singular stance toward online identity with Atsuyoshi Ishizumi, a senior research executive at Japanese market research firm Flamingo Tokyo. Atsuyoshi, who goes by Atsu, grew up in both Japan and the U.S., and he studied at Oxford University in England before joining Flamingo in Tokyo. He conducts regular research into Japanese and Western digital cultures for tech clients that have included Skype, Telefonica, and Twitter. Hi, Atsu. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
So you were researching technology and youth culture last year with Flamingo Tokyo, and as part of that research, you spoke to a student at the University of Tokyo who revealed that he has 15 different Twitter accounts. And it seems like having multiple Twitter accounts is apparently not an unusual thing in Japan. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on here?
Yeah, so the reason why I think it's common for Japanese people to have multiple Twitter accounts is that Japanese people like to compartmentalize or, you know, fragment their identities. So it's natural it's more instinctive for Japanese people to have multiple identities depending on, like, you know, different social spheres that you're in, maybe like an identity that you have that you put on when you're at school or in the workplace or with your family. It's just like a natural way of thinking for Japanese people.
Well, we all do that to some extent. I mean, you know, we all have our husband identity or our child identity or our student identity, and we sort of go through all of these all day long, and so everybody does that a little bit. What is it about Japanese culture that makes this a little different?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a universal thing to a certain extent. I guess what makes it unique to Japan is the extent to which people have to be aware of the identity that you put on, because, you know, you change the way you talk to people. There's like different forms of speech, depending on, you know, the social relationship that you're engaged in at the moment. So I think Japanese people are just more aware of the social surroundings you're in at the moment, and therefore more aware of that social identity that you have at that moment.
Could you give us an example? I know you've talked about the way that the Japanese language reflects these different ideas of social identity. How would that work in the real world? Can you give us an example?
Yeah, so there's this form of speech called keigo. So if I'm talking to someone who's older than me, I would have to be using different, you know, I would have to address him in a certain way. You would usually put san at the end, nani nani san, like Patrick san or something like that. And
yes.
And at the end of every sentence, there's a certain set of words that you have to put, or you have to add, to show that you're, you know, being polite and to show your respect to the person.
What does that mean for the way that they compartmentalize their identities?
I think just the act of doing something like that, the fact that, you know, you have to adjust yourself and your behavior depending on depending on who you're talking to, depending on the social distance that you have with the person you're communicating with. The fact that you have to adjust yourself creates within yourself like a different side to your core identity.
Right. And in the West, of course, almost every action that we take is judged as sort of a reflection of a core self. There's the basic us, and we're sort of expected to act pretty much the same in all circumstances. If we don't do that, you know, sometimes it seems that we're being a little schizophrenic. But you've said that the understanding of identity in Japan is a little different, and it allows itself to manifest in many different ways. How so?
This idea of identity in Japan is less absolute compared to that of the West. What I mean by that is that it's not always defined by what you think, but you know, it also like the social surroundings, the social sphere you're in, really defines who you are. Because you know, as I've been saying, it really conforms you and like changes you in a way that like the way you communicate and stuff, the way you try to present yourself really changes depending on who you're talking to and stuff. So in that sense, identity is more fluid, I think, in Japan.
In a blog post that you wrote for Flamingo last year with a colleague, you gave some interesting examples of this. Would you care to relate those examples for us?
Yeah, I think the examples that we mentioned were like a Buddhist monk, you know, when he's off duty, when he's not working at a temple or something, maybe he, this is just an example, so you know, just to illustrate the fact that, you know, the identity is more fluid here. But maybe it's okay for a monk to go into like a straight bar or to a club or something like that when he's not on duty, when he's not working. Because if you're not working, then you're not a monk. So like, you know, you have a different identity, you're a different person, so you're free to do whatever. Or another example is that like salaryman, when you're salaryman, if you're working for a corporation, if you're in the workplace, you have to behave in a certain way to, you know, to show respect to others in the office. But after working hours, you can get drunk and fall asleep on the train or something like that.
And that would be perfectly acceptable.
Yeah, actually, you see that a lot happening in Japan. Like, maybe it's not acceptable if your boss sees you doing that, but, you know,
right.
If for others to see, it's okay.
Or the head monk.
Yeah.
This aspect of Japanese culture, surely it must predate the internet and social media.
Right. It definitely does. Yeah.
And you've noted that in some senses, social media users in the West are playing catch up to Japan in this sense. What do you mean by that?
I'm not sure if catch up is the right word to use here, but I think what I was trying to say there is that as people start adapting themselves to this idea of, you know, having to control your identity online and then also in the offline world, I think people everywhere are becoming more aware of the need to, you know, have multiple identities. Because, you know, for example, I think this doesn't only happen in Japan, but also in the West. Like, if you're applying for a company or something, if you're applying for a position, you might want to be careful what to put on your Facebook page. Like,
sure,
maybe you don't want to put pictures of yourself partying.
As social media proliferate and people find themselves using more and more and sometimes different platforms out there, it becomes really important to be able to distinguish between which of these we're using for what purposes. And as you say, this is something that's really a recent, relatively recent phenomenon, just a decade or so old, the idea that we need to curate our lives online because we're warned constantly that what goes online stays online. It's all permanent. And just in the past few years, particularly young people, have become much more aware of the need to curate what goes online. And so often that means having very different identities, very different views of themselves and versions of themselves that are out there on different platforms. So in a sense, they are realizing an aspect of Japanese culture that's been around for hundreds of years in Japan.
Yeah, I think people are just realizing that, maybe what Japanese people have been doing naturally is actually something convenient for them to do in order to get around this digital world.
Well, let's talk about young people a little bit. I know that you guys at Flamingo do lots of research, and the research that you were doing was looking at technology and youth culture. And, because of the popularity of social media and online sharing platforms these days, there's a common misconception that young people today everywhere, millennials and post-millennials, that they don't really care about privacy. But it's becoming clear that that's not exactly true, is it?
Right, I agree. I think that's a misconception that actually Flamingo actually did research last year on the millennials and their perception towards the digital world, I think. And one of the findings that we had was that millennials, compared to other generations, actually care a lot about online privacy, and they're actually one of the most concerned generations when it comes to privacy online.
Which seems counterintuitive because there's sharing so much information, but as researchers like Dana Boyd has pointed out, they're very careful about what they're sharing and who they're sharing it with and all the context of that sharing, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. I think younger people just more conscious about what they share, like I guess the value of the information that they have, even when it comes to like interaction with when it comes to like interacting with brands and not just people. I think people are younger people especially are beginning to realize that the sort of information that they can provide could have a certain value in this digital world.
I absolutely agree. I mean, just a few years ago, I think lots of people, maybe even most people, weren't aware of that economy, how social media worked. They were like, "Oh, it's free, fantastic. I love it. I love free things." And I think just in the past, 2 or 3 years, people in general, and especially young people, have become much more aware of the transaction that is occurring when they use not just social media, but all of the internet. Do you find that that's equally true in Japan?
I think so. I think, yeah, especially for younger people here, but also in Japan, I would say there's this almost fear of the digital world, of the intangible. It's very much still a cash economy, not high penetration of credit card, and I guess compared to countries like the US. And I think people here just feel safer using the more physical mediums, and there's this affinity for the tangible in Japan.
What do you think is behind that, if you had to guess?
I think there is definitely appreciation for the aesthetics of some of the physical things. For example, physical CDs really sell well, still sell well in Japan. A new HMV store is actually opening in Tokyo, whereas like everywhere else in the world, like the business is doing not so well.
Right, yeah.
There's this appreciation, I guess, and for appreciation and celebration of the aesthetics of physical media, I think.
That's fascinating. Unlike China and South Korea, Japan has never really attempted to implement a real name policy for things like discussion forums and social media, have they? And I think a proposed national ID system has had a lot of difficulty getting public approval there. Is there any relation that you can see between these things and feelings in Japan about privacy and anonymity?
Yeah, so what I was telling you just now, the fact that people to a certain extent feel threatened by the intangible things that the digital world has to offer. I think that definitely has to do with this lack of online IDs and stuff in Japan. And also, that's one of the reasons why social platforms that play with the idea of anonymity do really well in Japan.
So by social platforms that play with anonymity, two that come to mind immediately are Mixi, which is very popular, perhaps even more popular than Facebook, or it has been for a long time. And another is the legendary bulletin board system, 2chan. Could you speculate on what makes anonymity so popular in Japan on these two platforms?
Yeah, I think, I mean, of course, there must be more than one reason, but sure. I think the biggest reason behind this is that, you know, I think these anonymous platforms provide sort of like an outlet for people, because as I was telling you earlier, that, you know, in Japan, people always have to be aware of the way they behave and they talk and stuff like that. So when it's anonymous, it kind of feels liberating because you don't have to care so much about what you say and the sort of the consequences that could come after what you say.
Sure. And I think everywhere that is one of the appeals of anonymity is that it allows people the freedom to express themselves without necessarily having to suffer, you know, the ill results of doing that. And people can tend to be, you know, more open in expressing themselves. But, you know, that's also one of the great disadvantages of anonymity is people say that it removes accountability for what is being said, because there's you can say anything without having to worry about being accountable for it. And so in a lot of places, we see this in China, we did see it in South Korea, and as well as in the West, there's a lot of interest in talking about how to limit anonymity or to, you know, eliminate it altogether. Is that kind of conversation or debate happening in Japan?
I think so. Yeah, definitely to a certain extent, there's a public backlash against these anonymous platforms. But I think also what's unique or what's interesting happening in Japan is that people are, you know, really playing with this idea of anonymity in like, in the sense that, you know, people create these fantasy profiles, fantasy identities. And, you know, if you go on Twitter, there's like multiple fake accounts run by Japanese people, like very random ones, like in maybe in English too, but like we call these bots.
Yeah.
And they generate like some very, very random tweets. That, yeah. Like I saw a bot called, it was like a dead bee bot or something.
Yeah.
And like it's just like a picture of a dead bee, and like it doesn't tweet. It just like tweets every hour like dot dot dot. Yeah. Like I think people are just really trying to take a positive approach to this whole idea of anonymity. So it's not only, you know, negative reaction towards this.
In a lot of the parts of the world, this is almost universal. The concern about anonymity is very often about concerns over cyberbullying and harassment and things like that. Is that something that people are talking about and worried about in Japan?
In certain communities, there are definitely lots of those concerns. But place like 2Channel, people have been doing it for so long, and that like even now, like the public has learned that that's a place where people say things without thinking, without being accountable for what they say. There's this common, you know, understanding that it's a special, different place for that sort of stuff. So like people go into it not worrying too much about what the 2Channel users say, not worrying what they say about you if you're using that 2Channel platform, because you're kind of like, you kind of know that these people are not like taking themselves seriously either. Yeah, because it's kind of becoming more mainstream to channel.
Yeah, well, it's the origin of, you know, sites like 4chan, and which, you know, has sort of given birth to the anonymous, you know, hacking vigilante collective. And you could even say that sites like 9gag originally emerged from 2chan. It's hugely influential around the world.
Right.
Atsu, thanks so much for joining us today. Can you tell us where we can follow what you're doing online?
I work for a research and a strategy agency called Flamingo. And so if you just go to our blog, we write a lot about, you know, digital culture here, not just digital, but like, you know, just Japanese society and culture in general. So that's flamingotokyo.com.
Great. And of course, I hope you'll follow me as I track the impact of the digital revolution across Asia, from China to India to Indonesia and everywhere in between. You could do that at facebook.com/AsiaDigitalLife. If you're a Google Plus user, just dial up google.com/plusAsiaDigitalLife. I'm also tweeting about all of this and more on Twitter every day at P. Sharbaugh. That's P-S-H-A-R-B-A-U-G-H. For now, the best place to listen to these podcasts is via my SoundCloud stream at soundcloud.com/AsiaDigitalLife. Thanks again, Atsu. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and keep it tuned. We'll be back soon.